Warning, Weird West Radio contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
See, in this world, there's two kinds of people, my friend. Those with loaded guns, and those who dig. You dig.
This town is called Redemption, right? I hear everyone in this town is wanted. Excuse me? I'm looking for Thomas Keller. Do you know him?
I am looking for a man named Thomas Keller. Wanted for the murder of Jess Rockefeller in New York City. He's wanted dead or alive.
My life ain't worth spit.
I want what's mine.
My town.
Body on my head. Don't come and get it.
My rules.
There's no reason for you to die here tonight.
I don't care about the risk.
Give me Thomas, or I'll collect on all your heads.
Praise the Lord! There's a price for that.
Welcome, everyone. This is Weird West Radio on Rain Man Digital. In this episode, we are going to be wrapping up our coverage of Westerns with Nicolas Cage in them with a discussion on the 2025 movie Gunslingers. Gunslingers is a 2025 American Western action film written, produced, directed, and edited by Brian Skiba. It stars Stephen Dorff, Heather Graham, and Nicolas Cage, and many more. It's a bit of an ensemble cast, which was surprising.
Very surprising.
I expected the movie to focus on our three leads, Heather Graham, well, our alleged leads, because even our leads, or at least the faces on the DVD cover, they're not really as prevalent in the movie as the plethora of other players.
Yeah.
And listen, we know why, you know, marketability, right? Sometimes as a producer in Hollywood in the low budget spheres, what do? You try to get those sexy names so you can get a distro deal and make some money. And that's the reason why you have films that may not be 100% focused on the actual character that's being used to promote the film. That's just the nature of the beast.
Yes.
So the synopsis: when the most wanted man in America surfaces in a small Kentucky town, his violent history and a bloodthirsty mob seeking vengeance and a king's ransom soon follow. As brothers face off against one another and bullets tear down the town to shreds, this lightning-fast gunslinger makes his enemies pay the ultimate price for their greed. Academy Award winner Nicolas Cage, Stephen Dorff, and Heather Graham star in an action-packed Western thriller about true justice in the Wild West. If you're new to the podcast, you can find most of our past episodes wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search Weird West Radio. Apple Podcast and Spotify users, please be sure to leave us a review and rate the podcast. Okay, so we began these discussions with the understanding that Cage is often an actor of excess, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
His performances frequently carry what you could call a surplus of energy, unpredictability, and theatrical instinct that can either elevate material or overwhelm it.
Yes.
In the previous Westerns we've covered, those eccentric tendencies were, in my view, sublimated for the most part, channeled through directors who understood how to harness Cage's volatility and essentially fold it into a broader dramatic structure.
Yes.
Now, with Gunslingers, some problems emerge. Here, Cage is given far less formal restraint, and the result is a performance style that often leads, or I should say often feels, detached from the tonal world around it. It's almost like he's acting in his own bubble.
Yeah.
And nothing else matters. The chosen characterizations and performative decisions appear less integrated, far less disciplined, and at times almost operating in a separate register from the film itself. It doesn't quite work. and it doesn't serve the narrative whatsoever.
Yeah, and that's what it when you are directing, one of the responsibilities of the director that we've all learned. This is something that we've learned from the basics of 101 in filmmaking. You're the director, you control the horses. The horses are the actors. You control them. You have to lead them. You don't necessarily have to actually, you know.
I mean, you can lead them to water, Dave, but you can't force them to drink.
Yeah, you can't force them to drink.
And obviously, Nicolas Cage was not drinking.
Oh, no. Well, and the sad part is he didn't even get led to the river. He just basically said, here we go. We're going to let you go. And all of a sudden, you know, he's up in the mountains somewhere.
So you're saying Skiba didn't even bother to bridle him and lead him to water. He took a gun, a six shooter, and shot it right next to his ear and had him just run crazy into the field.
Exactly. And here's the thing. Sometimes that works for Nicolas Cage because, you know, like
yes.
You get those viral memeable moments of Cage from that where the director just says, run with it. And then Nicolas Cage does the work and you get your viral moments that could possibly, you know, make people, oh, I gotta see Nicolas Cage go crazy in this film type thing. That's what I think a lot of directors try to do with Nicolas Cage and not understand that the best of Nicolas Cage is when you do that, but you also do it with him. You don't let him do it on his own. You got to give him some quote-unquote direction.
That's how most actors are. You know, they need direction. That's why we have directors. Now, that said, I don't want it to sound like the issues of this movie are Cage's fault. Far from it. He's an actor being hired to do a job. It's not his fault. This film has more problems than just Cage. The film is littered with just a plethora of problems from murky plot, failed character arcs, meaning things that never come to fruition.
Yep.
Narrative inconsistencies, particularly as it relates to narrative logic. This movie is a bit of a mess.
Oh, yeah.
Dave, give me your thoughts in a nutshell before we break everything down.
My thoughts in a nutshell about this film was this was a reminder to me of what filmmaking outside of Hollywood could be like, if that makes any sense for people listening.
Technically, though, this is a Hollywood picture.
It's technically, but there are telltale signs in this film that make me feel like, oh, this is definitely what people would classify as a zero budget film. Close to a student film. And the reason why I say that is because I've worked on films like this. So I know the telltale signs. And it's just like you said, is like you can, a lot of the badness of this film doesn't fall on the actors. This falls on a lot of things that basically, it's a death by a thousand cuts in this film. You know, whether it is just like what you said, a lot of like the inconsistencies with the narrative, but also the inconsistencies with the production value. Like when it comes down to cinematography, sound design, production design, films are like a tripod. Tripod stands successfully on three legs. That's what filmmaking is like. You need the tripod to work.
You already failed, David, because it's not called a tripod. It's called the sticks.
Sticks.
If you're in the filmmaking world.
But like, when you take a look at everything, there is a lot that make this film, quote unquote, what I've seen online, people have stated that this is a 5% on Rotten Tomatoes. And wow. I'm like going, I'm more forgiving.
Yeah, this isn't a deliberate, hey, I'm going to just give you guys a shitty film.
Shitty film.
I mean, more often films like these that feel rough, possibly cheap or poorly executed are just the results of constraints, you know, priorities or limitations. So it's not deliberate sabotage. I would even say it's amateur. It's not even necessarily because the director and producing teams are amateurs. That's clearly not the case. They have a lot of work under their belt. I think in the case of this particular film, you know, you're working in the sandbox of independent, low budget commercial space where, you know, speed and even deliverability often matter more than actual artistry.
Yes. And that's why I tell people a lot of supposed movie cinephiles out there don't seem to understand that basically there are reasons for certain films being made the way they are. And when you get into the super zero low budget films, speed and deliverability overcome anything. Like some of these distribution companies just want the content.
I remember when I was going through my distribution, negotiations, if you can call it that, such horseshit. When you're at a low level, you have literally no one on your side.
No.
So I remember talking to numerous people about getting distribution on a couple things that I was working on. And the first thing they ask, they don't care about how much money you put into it. They don't care about it. What's the level of completion? Who do you have in it? And if you answer someone who's unknown, what they'll do is go get someone who's known, put them in your movie, even if it's just for 5 minutes, and we sell it.
And that honestly is what I feel Nicolas Cage was there for. And I've worked a lot in this sphere of filmmaking to know that certain films that I've actually worked on and where I see not a A-list actor, but a higher level actor where they have a name get brought in, and then the director or the creative team at the time forces something else into the script just to fit that actor.
Yeah. I mean, we've done it.
What?
Yeah.
And the thing is, on a lot of Brian Skiba's past films, he's done it. And it's like a telltale sign that basically...
It's part of the process.
I was excited for this film at first because, oh my God, it's Brian Skiba, and he gets to actually work with Nicolas Cage and Stephen Dorff.
Well, for those people who may not be aware that might have missed our first two discussions, and I don't want to get too personal... I'm trying to, and I'm not talking about insulting in regards to the personal, because we have past relations. That sounds sexual. We have had past relationships with many of these people.
Yes.
And I don't want to sit here and just trash them, because we know how much work goes into making movies, specifically this movie. It's not an easy process. So we're trying to be a little more charitable when talking about someone that we know. You actually have worked with Brian Skiba. So
yes, I have.
We're trying to be careful, just because I don't want to insult someone's ability to work. I mean, this guy is a working director. Obviously, he knows what he's doing. He continually gets work. I mean, I think he puts out at least at minimum, what, one or two movies a year?
Yeah. Brian Skiba pounds the pavement, as it were, as a filmmaker. He does the work. He is doing what filmmakers who want to be called a filmmaker need to do.
And that's why I appreciate Skiba's effort here, because I know his coming up story. It's a hard story. It's everyone's dream. I'm going to work and do a bunch of things I don't want to do so I can make movies. And he did exactly that. So you have to admire that. Now, for me, just to move on a bit here, what I really liked about the movie is the premise. It's a really good premise.
It is.
The idea that you have this guy, Thomas, who's played by Stephen Dorff, who has the largest reward in history on his head, and he's on the run. And there's this town that takes in outlaws, helps them fake their own death, and then assist them in reintegrating into society under a false name. They give them a new life.
Yeah.
That's an interesting and incredibly unique premise for a Western.
You know, the amazing thing to me is when I saw the premise, that was one of the things that was interesting because it sounds like a spaghetti Western from the 1970s that I would love to have watched.
David, and that's what I was hoping. I was hoping that this movie was purposely absurdist.
Yes.
Possibly even purposely designed to be a B film, but it wasn't really intended to be any of those things. No. It's just a low budget effort.
Yes. There's no style to it.
That's the nail on the head right
that's
there.
That's the nail on the head because you have this premise that is tailor-made not to be taken seriously by, you know, like, especially nowadays where a lot of Western fans, you know, there's always that debate. Do you go more historically accurate or do you actually go more the absurdist route? For a lot of like fans who love the spaghetti Westerns, it's better to go the absurdist route. So when you see like a premise like this, you like go, oh, okay, this is going to be exploitive. This is going to be out there. You're not supposed to look at this through a historic eye. And I thought that, oh, this is a home run for it because to me, that's where Brian Skiba, that's his bread and butter. A lot of the past films that I know about him and I've worked with him are more like in the horror genre where it's very absurd.
Yeah, it's
stylized exploitive filmmaking.
Yeah, and purposely being what Skiba is attempting to make it be. And what I mean by that is there isn't intentional badness in this movie. You know, sometimes directors purposely do certain things. You have camp, you have grindhouse, homages, B-movie, pastiche, self-aware excess, and absurdism. That is different from accidental badness.
Yes. Yeah.
And I feel like this movie might fall into that a bit. But again, I don't know if it has anything to do with skill level because there's many people involved in this movie who are not possibly talented. They are, in fact, talented. So that then lends itself more to the logic that this has to do simply with the workings and going-ons of distribution deals, deliverabilities, basically timing.
Yeah.
And all of that stuff. And also you're dealing with low budget limitations. Low budget Westerns are expensive. It's better not to make a low budget Western unless you know for sure you can handle this movie within the allotted budget. For example, there is a film that recently came out called Frontier Crucible. That is exactly this, meaning it's similar in its strategy as Gunslingers. It's low budget fare, but it knew what it was going to be. It knew its restraints and it wrote the script according. This movie feels like, hey, listen, we know we're not going to have the budget that most Westerns have, but we're going to write this big anyways. We're going to write this excessive anyways. And then when we don't have money to cover the excess, we'll just make do. There's a difference.
Yeah.
You have a director like the director for Frontier Crucible working within those budgetary confines prior to even setting foot on set because the script itself was written within those restraints.
Yeah.
Like I said a moment ago, this script was written without those limitations in mind. And I think that's probably why the movie starts to fall apart in many ways, because when you have so many things piled up into the back of the wagon, when the wagon starts to move and the wagon is poorly constructed because you didn't have the right money to use proper lumber, right wheels and axles, what's going to happen? Things are going to start falling off the back and eventually the wagon's going to break and just completely go off the cliff.
Yeah.
So that's ultimately, in my opinion, was probably wrong with this movie. What happened to this movie? Because after the initial premise, the movie just continues to slip further and further into poor quality.
Yes.
So let's just tackle the story for the moment.
Okay.
People do things that just don't make a lot of sense. Thomas Keller, played by Stephen Dorff, has a brother who is the main antagonist. We're not really quite sure why his brother, Robert, was willing to betray his brother after those opening moments when Thomas killed a Rockefeller member.
Yes.
To protect his brother. And we're kind of left the entire movie. Okay, is there going to be a reveal why he really is so passionately against his brother and he's the one hunting him down? And listen, we understand that the Rockefellers gave his brother an ultimatum. Go get your brother or you take the consequences. Okay, that's motivation. But what's the psychological motivation? Where's the brotherly motivation? Where's the talking, the back and forth between two brothers so that we as an audience can believe that this person would do such a thing? There isn't a lot of that logical explanations. You also have, and I should say, in the end, you could probably just shrug and say the brother, Robert Keller, is a wacko. And that's that. But this problem is actually part of a bigger problem, which means the justification behind his motivational incoherence is not simply he's crazy. It becomes a symptom of the writing itself, because those same problems, those inconsistencies, the incoherent character arcs or characterizations end up being problems or patterns in nearly every character in this movie. You have a character that betrayed the town, because obviously if you are a town dedicating to hiding outlaws, there are secrets, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, one member of the town, Thalia, I believe it was her name, is the one who sold the town out.
Yes.
Why?
Yeah.
The whole movie, you're wondering why. And she's not just doing it for greedy reasons, because she never talks about money. She doesn't really talk that much. So then you wonder, well, maybe she's evil. She's just a bad seed because she looks evil. Her costuming, makeup, they make her look sociopathic at times. Like she has a bit of a bloodlust. She wants to kill people. Okay, yeah. But why? Why this town? What's the motivation? There's no motivation. Why was she willing to kill the daughter of the town leader? Why? Why was she so intent on doing that at the end of the movie? There is no explanation. And then you have Cage's Ben, which is the name of his character, and his odd way of talking and his connection to another character named Mary, which is never made clear what this connection is. And it doesn't even materialize to anything because Mary burns up in the streets. And Cage never remarks about her death, even though he was adamant throughout most of the movie about protecting Mary.
Yeah.
I must protect Mary, because this is how he talks. He talks like this. Oh, praise Jesus and the Lord. Mary.
Amen.
Mary. It is the most contrived voice. Nicolas Cage is a good actor, but in this movie, he's bad.
And
the voice sounds like someone... It sounds like when you're 5 years old and you are trying to mimic your grandfather, I'm going to try yes, to sound like an old yeah. person.
And that's the thing that I think really is frustrating for me, is like, there's these little things where we are wondering why is this character doing this? Why is this? And there's no explanation. That's the problem.
Well, what I thought, and I'm going to go off for a moment here. Because of the way he talked, I assumed it has something to do with him at one point, because you got to remember, nearly everyone in this town is an outlaw. So I figured, okay, at some point in this character's life, he was lynched. He escaped. And the reason why his voice sounds like that is because, as we know, when you have been strung up and nearly hanged to death, oftentimes your voice never reverts back to what it was.
Yeah, your vocal cords.
It stays strangled sounding. So I'm like, okay, you know what? His voice sounds stupid, because at the end, we're going to find out that he was hanged once and escaped.
Well, especially that scene where everyone's being...
David? That's okay, so we're on the same page.
Yeah.
So there's a scene in which I will say is an excellent scene. It's the best scene in the movie. I love orchestrated, well-directed action sequences where you have a bunch of things going on and you have the good guys being strung up by the bad guys. So basically, the gallows trap door did not fall completely. So yeah. During the action sequence. You have three of our characters basically slowly dying as they're trying to use their feet to stay from falling completely through the trap door. It's an excellent scene.
Yeah.
Nicolas Cage's character finally has a point. Because he doesn't have a point the entire movie. He goes and he goes and he tries to help them by lifting the trap door underneath the gallows. And it's funny and it works. He finally, by the end of the movie, he's able to save them. And they're all now talking like him. Because why? They were being strangled to death. And I'm waiting. I'm like, this is it. You're going to find out when Nicolas Cage is going to say some wry remark to them. Like, now you guys know why I talk like this. Nope. They exactly. all just sound like him. And that would have been the perfect moment to pinpoint why Cage talks the way he does. They yes. bypass. And that's my problem with this movie. There is no true deep thought behind plot and the things that happen.
There's no payoffs.
There's no payoffs. And to me, that payoff wrote itself. The fact that we both saw it, David, should say that payoff writes itself. And maybe they did. Maybe it was really quick. Maybe we didn't pick up on it because we were already frustrated. So forgive me out there, viewers, if you watch this movie and you are saying to yourself right now, no, they did. They did use that. Maybe we missed it, but I rewound it and I didn't hear it. So there's things like that. And usually I don't go into a lot of plot eccentric diatribes, but that is the biggest problem with the movie, is the plot incoherence.
Oh yeah.
The A to B to C does not make sense. And the same thing within the narrative itself, with the actual character narratives, the individual character arcs, they're incoherent and they're incomplete and oftentimes illogical.
Well, here's the thing. If you were to do, if that mistake was only done once in the film, just once, I'd overlook it.
Correct.
The problem with this movie is it happens multiple times. I mean, the one time that for me that sticks out is the saloon scene where Thomas and Robert are actually having that conversation. And you have this moment when Robert can actually tell Thomas why he's doing this. And he doesn't. they just have this diatribe between each other that amounts to nothing.
Well, they try to build up this camaraderie amongst these town people, and they just force it because you never understand why any of them really. I mean, yes, you get that they're all in the same boat, so that's why they have loyalties to each other. But you can tell there's a story to every single one of them, and they allude to these stories, but we never fully understand anyone's motivation outside the superficial.
And This is where I basically feel this falls slightly onto Skiba, because this sounds like, for me, the director goes over to with the actors, goes over their characters, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he's not on the same page with his crew. So his cinematographer doesn't know what he's shooting. His script supervisor doesn't fucking know what they're looking at to make sure that they're shooting the right things. So that's where I basically go.
So okay. You're saying that, okay, let me see if I understand so that we can also clarify a bit more. So when you shoot a film, you shoot things out of order. And because you shoot things out of order, you never shoot in linear fashion.
Never.
Very seldom will a movie do that. And if they do, it's usually for some gimmick. So that being said, you may shoot a scene, the cinematographer will shoot a scene at the beginning of the movie, and then in the same day, they're going to shoot something at the end. And if he's not fully invested in the script and he doesn't understand the emotions, the emotional atmosphere, the emotional aesthetics, then it may not be captured correctly.
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I agree.
And I see that throughout the entire film. So it's kind of like, We bring up the one scene as the gallows scene is like this, but it's like, that's just one of the many, many missed
opportunities
that the crew had to actually give us something of substance as we're watching.
Well, David, this is why I'm wondering, and I want to get your thoughts on this, because I agree with all of that. And rather than nitpicking every performance and every character, because I had a problem with pretty much every character except Stephen Dorff. Stephen Dorff's character is the only one that felt more complete. But even that, because you only have one half of the coin that you understand, you don't understand the antagonist that much, that it, you kind of lose something. But Stephen Dorff is such a powerful actor and such an unappreciated performer that he can do a lot with very little, because he does a lot of emoting. There's a lot of things going on in his face.
Yes.
He's a very good actor, and he is the silver lining to this entire movie. But I think what happened, David, goes right back to budget restraints. The director wanted to do something big. The amount of time to completion, to where they needed to deliver the film, obviously wasn't long enough, because oftentimes the movie feels like, okay, let's just move on now from this. And because of that, you never really learn much about anyone. In my opinion, what would have worked better for this movie is they should have eliminated 50% of the cast.
Oh, absolutely.
If not 70%. And they should have focused on our core characters and flesh them out. This movie is an hour and 40 minutes, and I feel like you could have made this an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And it would have been a stronger movie if you did away with the unnecessary gunslingers in this town. I understand it's built into the premise, but get rid of them. Kill them off early and then focus on three or four survivors, because there is a survivor aspect to this. Not that this is a horror film, but it has that vibe to it where you're being attacked. The town is being attacked by a powerful force. You're only a few people against many, and we only have until morning. It's kind of like that setup.
Yeah.
It almost feels like Skiba might have been writing a horror film at one point, maybe a vampire Western, and then he displaced the vampires later on because of, let's say, budget reasons, and decided to fill it up with regular people and make this a more straight or standard Western. But that's the biggest problem. There's just too much in a movie that is not able to handle all of it.
And that's the thing, is especially with the fact that Stephen Dorff obviously is the lead actor, right? But a lot of the attention in certain aspects goes to Nicolas Cage. And it's kind of like, that's where, you know, I feel that, just like what you said, there's those moments in production when basically they're looking at the time frame of, oh, we only have Mr. Cage for this many days. We got to hammer everything in those days just to get his shots done. Well, we also have Mr. Dorff, and it goes into, like, you know, production,
scheduling and budget,
scheduling and production. And it feels like everything that was shot in the film was like shot, run and gun. Let's just basically shoot what we can.
And let's just get this in the can,
get it in the can.
Yeah.
And
you know what? And those priorities aren't necessarily wrong.
I mean, it worked,
but it just worked. Doesn't lend itself. Those priorities are not necessarily wrong. And they're also understandable.
Yeah.
They're very real limitations and priorities that, you know, if you're going to make your next movie and you expect money to be given to you by the studio, then you better deliver when they want.
Exactly.
So I get all of these problems. I get it. It's just unfortunate because the problems don't stop there, David. I mean, this rolls over now into cinematography, which I can forgive bad scripts, because unfortunately, Hollywood films are filled with bad scripts. Even those movies that make countless millions of dollars, sometimes I scratch my head and wonder, how did this movie make so much money with such a bad script? So I can forgive bad scripts or poorly written scripts, shoddy scripts within indie circles. But one thing I can't forgive is the attention to quality and detail overall. Cinematography was atrocious. I'm just going to say it. And I feel bad saying that, but it was awful. One of the film's visual problems, particularly, is its handling of firelight. Or fire in general.
Yes.
Rather than appearing as, you know, a textured flame that's integrated into the scene, the fire actually often will register as an overexposed bloom of light, which then flattens the image, undermines realism that such practical lighting should actually provide. So when fire is used as a practical light source within the mise-en-scene, torches, lanterns, campfires, candles, burning buildings, the cinematographer is supposed to expose for both the flame itself and the environment the flame is meant to illuminate. If that balance is mishandled, Dave, we all know what happens. The flame clips into a glowing blob or bloom of white, yellow light rather than retaining shape, texture, and movement. And that was all over this movie.
Yes.
Torches, candles, everything was hot and overly exposed.
Yes.
Now, why does this happen? I'm going to go through some lists. And please jump in, Dave, because I know you have your own thoughts on this. Because I actually was sent a message from one of our listeners who was following our discussions and said they jumped ahead and watched Gunslingers. And they mentioned the fire specifically. So the reason why this can happen, flames are much brighter, obviously, yes, than their surroundings. They are a fucking light source. A dark night scene with a campfire creates extreme contrast. If exposure favors actors' faces or even the background, the flame can then be blown out. If exposure favors the flame, everything else may fall into darkness, which in my opinion is preferable.
Yes.
Now, cheap digital capture, aggressive grading, which is probably also a problem with this, not digital capture, but the aggressive grading. And even the compressed streaming versions can worsen it, which we know the bandwidth of streaming, even for 4K, is just not nearly as good as physical media. So how do you account for this? So the camera dynamic range and sensors response to the highlight. So basically, when fire is part of the scene's lighting design, production should consider the camera's dynamic range, the supplemental hidden lighting that lifts the actors in background, so exposure doesn't rely solely on the flame. Of course, you have diffusion control tools to shape the light, lens choices, aperture, ISO to manage highlights. These are things that all cinematographers should already know.
Yes.
And I'm only sharing this not to educate cinematographers, but to explain why something might have looked a certain way,
yes,
in a movie to our listeners. There are reasons why. This wasn't intentional. This wasn't a style. No one's going to choose a poorly exposed fire as style.
Exactly. And the problem with specifically the cinematography in this film is, for me, the way it's shot, there is nothing. Everything looks so flat. Everything, it looks like, and the best example I could find to explain this is like with the visuals in this film, they remind me of something being shot for television, where, you know, television back, if you look at the difference of back then of television and film, television tends to be really flat. It's almost looks like it's a stage play. Right? It's that soap opera look. And that's what I get from Gunslingers, is like this soap opera look. And I'm like going, this looks terrible for a film.
Yeah.
Especially if you're trying to do a Western.
Well, okay. So you are right about all of that. And you're also, of course, right about the flat look. Now, just to be fair, it's possibly the location they were shooting, the exterior. There did seem to be a lot of overcast, but an overcast does not mean the production just shoots anyways. There's still ways to create the necessary fill and backlighting. A good example of this is another movie we covered about a year and a half ago, Old Henry.
Yeah.
Old Henry, if I remember correctly, had a lot of flat scenes, let's just say, because there was the overcast. But yeah, when you look carefully, the reason why it looked professional is because even though there was an overcast, they still properly lit. They still use the proper fill. It's proper ratios.
Yeah. And that's...
It seems like here, David, that they just kind of pointed and shot.
Exactly. That's why I say is like, this falls totally on the cinematographer. And also basically makes me bring up the question is like, did Brian choose the cinematographer for the proper, because as a filmmaker and a director, one of your responsibilities too is to actually make sure you choose the right cinematographer for your right, for your project.
Well, I think he chose him for the right money. I think is why he chose that.
And that's the problem is like, if you're just going to go and choose him for the money aspect, instead of looking at going, oh, is this the right cinematographer for my project? That's when I basically go, this is what happens, because I honestly feel that the cinematographer that he chose for this was not equipped to deal with shooting a Western. And, you know, I looked up at the cinematographer's filmography and I'm like going, oh yeah, you look at his filmography. Gunslingers is like the one. He has a very vast filmography, but Gunslingers is like the one that sticks out, where it's like everything else is a certain style. But Gunslingers is the one where it's like, oh, that's a totally different beast. And it's like, this cinematographer was not probably skilled to take care of this genre.
If you look at the cinematographer and many of the players involved, they come from the same field that Skiba has found himself in. I call them Hallmark Channel producers and directors. And that's not a...
It's not a knock.
That's not, no, not at all. I mean, that's a real career where you make real money and get to exercise your creativity. But it is a style of filmmaking almost in itself. And I started thinking about that, David, when you mentioned soap operas, because soap operas are also almost its own thing in terms of operation and procedure. I mean, obviously, they all follow similar, you know, procedures and do's and don'ts, but there is a style of shooting and priorities when you're working within a type of sensibility. And if you look at the cinematographer that shot this movie, I mean, he does TV movies.
Yeah.
He does. That's, if you look at his career, that's 50% of his, his work or more.
More than 50%.
Are films that are made directly for television. And when I say television, we're not talking about HBO or Cinemax. We're talking about the bottom tier broadcast cable channels, I should say, the bottom tier cable channels like Hallmark.
Yeah. And that's not basically saying that the cinematographer is, you know, bad at his job.
It just explains.
I just think this is the wrong cinematographer for this project.
He's a product of the work he does. I mean, if you're working within one sensibility, that's probably what you're going to bring to the table if you're hired. If what you do is straight to TV movies, then you're going to bring that style. And obviously we know, well, maybe they don't know, Brian Skiba does fall into that category as well. He's what you would call a straight to TV movie type of director. Yeah, because if you look at Brian Skiba's body of work as a director, I mean, he appears to be a prolific working director and producer in the indie action thriller lane. And he's done a couple Westerns, I believe. So, and that often means efficiency, packaging, and completion are part of that skill set. So to say that this is a talentless film or a skillless film would be disingenuous, because these types of movies, as we've said already, they prioritize a different level of skill. And that skill is efficiency, packaging, and completion. Because that's what these movies are made for, ultimately.
Yeah.
So the film, I would say, feels less like a failed artistic ambition than a production built around expediency, where I guess you could say commercial completion overtakes any type of formal precision. All right, so production notes. In May 2024, it was announced that post-production had begun on a Western action film titled Gunslingers. After filming occurred in Cave City, Kentucky, Barron County, Hart County, Edmondson County, Brian Skiba wrote, co-produced, and directed the film with Nicolas Cage, Stephen Dorff, Heather Graham, Scarlett Rose Stallone. That's who the other woman was. Okay. Randall Battenkoff, and many more. The release was originally a theatrical release in some parts of the United States, but ultimately it was a video on demand release on April 11th. On the review aggregator website, Rotten Tomatoes, 5% of critics' reviews are positive, with an average rating of 3.2 at Metacritic. And it assigned the film a score of 22 out of 100.
The one thing that I wanted to add was the fact that I was laughing at Mike when I found out about this. I had this in my notes. Mm-hmm. Apparently it got nominated for the one of the Golden Raspberries, which is something that I take personal because that those are the awards for like bad films.
Yeah.
And I was like cracking up and going, what the hell did it win for Golden Raspberry? And then I looked at it like, oh my God, Nicolas Cage won for worst act.
No, he got nominated.
Oh, he got nominated?
He got nominated, and Scarlett Rose Stallone won. And I want to say something really quick. If I know, let me check to make sure this is the right character. Yes, Belle. Okay. I'm sorry to say that Scarlett Rose Stallone was far from the worst actor in this movie. Oh, she was actually one of the better ones.
That's the scarier part.
She was one of the better ones. So I don't agree with her getting the Golden Raspberry. One of the worst performances in the movie is actually Nicolas Cage.
It is. It is Nicolas Cage because like there's no control of him.
And I got mad a few times at Heather Graham, not because of her acting, but because the story that was written for her was so, I'm sorry. It was so, there are things that are just stupid. She decides to put her daughter to sleep in the so hold on a second. I got to say this. So towards the latter half of the film, all of the good guys, our heroes, are trapped in a saloon / hotel. There's no escape. It's surrounded by the enemy, and the enemy is just unloading, okay? Shooting relentlessly. It's an all-out war. For some reason, in the midst of all this, Heather Graham, who has a daughter, decides to take her up to the room to go to sleep. It's time to sleep now, honey.
I don't get it. I'm like,
excuse me, but people are being shot all around you. What are you doing? And to make matters worse, she decides she's going to read a bedtime story.
Do you know what dawned on me, Mike, when I saw this scene? That scene in particular, some strange reason, I had this like weird feeling that someone on the production basis said, hey, do you guys remember Face Off? Remember when the boy put on his headphones and they had a gunfight around him? Let's do that.
Yeah, but you know what, David? John Woo made sense there because he was at least, for purposes of style, was A, trying to naturally push the music somewhere over the rainbow into the diegetic.
Yes.
Okay. For style reasons. And also putting the headphones on his head, having the kid close his eyes so he doesn't witness or hear the violence around him. Even though it's silly, it makes sense logically.
This
makes no sense. But who in their right mind is going to put their child to bed in a room where any wild gunfire can just take them out?
I know.
Okay. Not only can they just be taken out by wild ammo or wild gunfire that goes awry, but also there is shooting happening. How do you expect a child to rest easy when there's gunfire all over the fucking hotel?
When they've already, and they see it coming too.
Yeah. You know what would have made more sense? And these are the things that, and I don't want to dogpile on this movie, but those are the things that to me, I just can't forgive because that doesn't require a major rewrite. It requires just simply using critical thinking.
Yes.
Because you could have still had that sequence, but rather than putting your child to bed, it would have made more sense if Heather Graham's character was trying to protect the child by stashing them away in an attic, or I want you to hide in this room behind the bed. Here's your favorite book. Read your book. I don't want you downstairs. Hide. Do not get close to the windows. Wouldn't that have worked just the same and made more sense?
Yeah.
That's how easy it is. That doesn't even require a rewrite. It requires just simply thinking. I mean, how did Heather Graham not say, okay, can I raise my... I have a problem here. This makes no sense.
This makes no sense.
Isn't there a shootout happening? And maybe this goes right back to what you were saying, David, about the cinematographer possibly not even understanding that current emotional moment.
Yeah.
Like what's happening, because we know films are shot of order, out of order. So maybe Heather Graham didn't even realize that this scene took place in the midst of a gunfight.
Yeah. This, and that's what I mean, is like, this is like, this goes beyond just saying, and the thing I do not agree with what people do is like they dogpile on one or two elements just on this film, saying that it's their fault that this is bad.
No, overall, the movie is kind of weak.
Yeah. Overall, the badness falls on everybody. It's just not the director, and it's just not, you know, the actors.
Except maybe Dwarf.
Yeah, it's everybody. Everybody needs to actually be doing their quote unquote jobs to get the film made. And like the thing that you just mentioned, the cinematographer, hell, the script supervisor should actually be looking at that going, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. Yeah. You know, and you know, just like you say, bring up the whole thing about, yeah, this doesn't quite make sense, and bring it up to the director, see what the director says and everything else, because it's a team effort. And that's why I walk away from this basically saying this isn't the director's fault. And this isn't because of Nicolas Cage. This is just an overall mess.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a 5%, although I would say there's definitely an argument to be made for it being 5%. But to be fair, and just knowing the amount of work that goes into making a movie like this and the ambition, and also the intended purpose of a movie like this, taking all that into account, I would probably give this movie a 27 or 30%. You know what? I'm going to give it a 27%.
My score is about like a 32%, because like you can't, a 5% would mean that basically it is a total failure and it's a affront.
And it also represents a general lack of understanding of what goes into making movies.
Exactly.
If you give this movie a 5%.
If you give it a 5%, it's kind of like, do you even know what it takes to actually make a film?
I have given a movie 1% before, but we won't talk about that. very rare for me to give anything below 20.
And that's the thing, is kind of like, because we know how much work goes into making a film, we also understand that basically sometimes a filmmaker could be overwhelmed. They could get their dream job, but suddenly everything else just overwhelms them, and they're out of their element at that point. And honestly, this crew was out of its element. When you look at it, the cinematographer to me is like, well, you got a cinematographer who doesn't really have that style to actually do this type of film.
I agree. I think the ambition for this movie outweighed the skill set that was involved in this movie. And yes, that's not to say that these people weren't talented. It's to say that they probably should have hired, the producer probably should have hired people that were better qualified for handling such an ambitious script.
Yeah. Like they basically took on a project that was, you know, bigger than they thought, especially when you throw into the adage of having actors like Steven Dorff, like Heather Graham, like especially like Nicolas Cage, because then the bad filmmaking makes you look worse, in my opinion, because people like, I hate to say it, but people like me look at that, go, you had this opportunity given to you to get this really good project done with very named actors. You should have put your best foot forward.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end. And also, this is the end of our Nicolas Cage in Westerns coverage.
Oh, amen.
Oh, praise Jesus. Praise Jesus. Oh, God, dude. I mean, like, listen, Nicolas Cage, listen, buddy, I love you. But if I was directing him, I'm like, nah, dude. X-nay on the voice A.
X-A on the Mary A. Yeah.
Dude, I don't want to dogpile, but dude, that was one of the things that frustrated me. That Cage's character was seemingly preoccupied with Mary the entire movie. And then, and then when it mattered, nothing came of it.
Nothing came of it.
All right, let's close it out. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Foresaid he be taken from such prison to a suitable and convenient place of execution within said county, and there be hanged by the neck till he be dead, dead, dead. Now, do you have anything to say, young man?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. You can go to hell, hell, hell.